Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 559. So the big news for us is that At Midnight has been picked up for season two. So, season two, by the way, is pretty much all of 2015, so we'll be on for a while. So thank you very much if you've been watching and playing along, and please continue to do so. I'd also like to say, hey, there are a lot of other fun podcasts on the Nerdist Podcast Network that maybe you might want to check out, like Humans from Earth. Jeff Boucher has an exclusive chat with Frank Miller. Also, The Indoor Kids has Tenacious D. And follow the antics of TJ Miller at Cashing In with TJ Miller. And check those out. You go to iTunes, or you can go to Nerdist.com and subscribe, or go to Libsyn, which is where they're hosted. That's also a helpful place to find podcasts. And thank you for continuing to enjoy the many wares that we place before you in this digital marketplace. This podcast is Sean Bean, who was rad. We went to his hotel couple weeks ago in Los Angeles. By the way, he is promoting a show called Legends on TNT that premieres tonight, Wednesday. Today is the 13th of August, and it's at 9 p.m. I don't know if you guys saw the campaign at Comic-Con in San Diego this year, but the TNT basically did this campaign of Don't Kill Sean Bean. I posted a picture of a T-shirt with that on Instagram, but it basically means he dies a lot in shows. Hey, audience, we know you hate seeing Sean Bean die. We promise we will not kill Sean Bean on our show. You give us your attention, we will give you a living Sean Bean for as long as the show goes. So Sean was great. There are pretty major Game of Thrones spoilers in this podcast, though. So if you have not seen Game of Thrones, you're not caught up, or you don't want to know anything that happens, then maybe stop right now and catch up on Game of Thrones today, and then come back and listen to the rest of the podcast. But beside that, here's the Nerdist Podcast number 559 with Sean Bean.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Watching what happened on television the last couple nights, but we were just talking about Sharknado 2. Did you miss it? Did you see any Sharknado?
No.
All right.
Yeah. I'll say, so even if you didn't see it, you would never miss it. Yeah. What?
I saw it advertised.
Yeah, I think that's about. I got the gist. Yeah. I didn't bother seeing it. I think the ads pretty much got it.
NATO, Sharknado.
Yeah, yeah. It's about sharks.
It's a tornado made of sharks.
I thought it was NATO.
Yeah, no, sharks, no, with the North American Trade Agreement. Yeah, or organization.
That would actually have some. That would actually have some social weight to it. No, this is a tornado made of sharks that basically flies through the air and kills people.
It's the second one.
Okay, now.
We're just talking about
the second one.
Yeah, it was the sequel to that.
Yeah.
It's just, here's the thing. I like a good bad movie, like a movie that someone legitimately tried to make and it wasn't that good. So it's kind of fun to watch. But when someone purposely makes a movie to be bad, I think is kind of a waste of money.
Yeah.
I think it's a waste of time. Yeah.
It's a little hipstery. Yeah. But we're here to talk about you, Sean Bean.
Yeah.
How you doing, man?
I'm good, thanks. Yeah,
good.
Yeah.
Are you having a press? Is this a press day?
Yeah.
Just all
depressing
day long.
Day.
If you want, we could just use this time to just have quiet time if you need. We don't have to talk about any of that stuff. We can talk about you. Hey, I want to. I've had conversations before, like with people like Dominic Monaghan, people who are really. Is it right if I call it soccer, or do I need to call it football?
Okay. Okay. Either.
You're in the London Hotel.
Call it football. Yeah, this is.
But it is really.
This is part of England, right? This hotel is officially football. Part of it.
They just call it hotel.
They just call it hotel. I've always really wanted to understand it, and I don't. And I know that you adore it. Would you please tell me, when you're watching a football game, what are you seeing? What is it that you're watching for?
I guess it's that a lot of it is skill. A lot of it is the club that you support. It can get very, very tribal and very passionate, which is sometimes a good thing, maybe sometimes not, but that's what kind of keeps it alive, the fans. That's a very exciting aspect of soccer and the atmosphere and how many of some fans bring to your ground and how many you take to theirs and the banter and on the terraces and the funny songs and stuff like that. But it's also that, you know, what's happening on the pitch and the skill and the, you know, the commitment. You know, something we're very passionate about. Maybe that's why I'm trying to think of a comparison, you know, with maybe baseball or maybe ice hockey. Maybe they've got that kind of similar kind of mentality. But it's very difficult to put your finger on. I mean, I think it is, as they say, it is a beautiful game, and I think it is. And it was also invented in Sheffield, where I come from.
Right.
So I hope everybody knows that.
Have you been to an actual match, though? Have you ever been to a live soccer match?
I've never been to a soccer match, what's interesting to me is how much more intense and passionate the fans can. I mean, like American football, I feel like we have kind of goofy fans. You know, it's like, I painted my body two colors, and I'm super drunk, and I'm gonna, you know, if there's a fight, it's like a bar fight. But soccer is like, I'm going to rip your fucking eyes out, and, you know, because you support, because you're wearing the other colors.
Sure, yeah. It's not all like that, you know what I mean? There's a lot of good human stuff as well. And, you know, but because it is so passionate, because people are so intense about it, that's what makes it so exciting and so interesting to watch. You know, and I guess it's like we've all been brought up since we were kids on soccer. You know, my grandfather and my dad, and we always used to go together, and you grow up with it. And there's different, you know, I support Sheffield United, and there's another club in Sheffield, which I won't mention. So that's, you know, that's what makes it interesting. Maybe you should watch a bit more.
Maybe I should.
Or go to a football match. Go to a match in London or somewhere, or one of the local derbies.
Seeing it live is what kind of got me into watching it live and
trying to feel what it feels like to be a part of it. Because if you don't really understand something and you're seeing it on a two-dimensional screen, you're just like, what happens? And you can only focus on what the cameraman is telling you to focus on. Like, you can't, you don't really have the experience.
Yeah, I think if you sat with the crowd and they're telling you what's going, you know, they're saying, oh, this is this guy. We just bought that guy. He's good. He's not very good. Blah, blah, blah.
He's
a great winger. He's going to kick the ball over. You know, that's where you get the excitement. When there's somebody telling you, like commentators, you know, you're obviously just listening to them, but you've got to be there and experience it. And I bet if you go to a good one, a good local derby in Yorkshire or Liverpool or London, you'd come away, you know, quite hooked, I think.
Yeah, that's how I was saying earlier with hockey. Like, you know, I kind of didn't really care for it. Then I went to a game, and then my friend was sitting next to me. He was doing the same thing. It's like a couple games ago, this guy, you know, he was taken out of the game because he beat up a dude. And then this guy used to be with this team, you know, and you kind of get
a lot of rivalry.
Yeah, and you get the narrative of it. Once it becomes kind of a narrative, that's what really builds everything.
That's the story. Yeah. Basically, you're going for the story.
Yeah.
You must have played.
I played when I was younger quite a bit, at school. And I used to play for some pub teams. And I kind of stopped that when I became an actor. They started recognising me, and they were all trying to slide tackle me and hoof me off the pitch. So I thought, fuck this.
Not trying to ruin the moneymaker right here, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, fuck up the face.
Nut me. Yeah, but it got a bit rough saying, oh, that's him who was on television, that's the actor, yeah, let's fucking do it. I said, whoa, hold on, sure. Man, I'm fucking pub games, I'm getting my legs broke here.
This guy wear a face guard.
Concentrate on my acting.
That's my favorite. I think one of my favorite things about British culture is that they will recognize if you're taking yourself too seriously, and they will fucking take you down a peg if they feel like you're and I kind of like that the culture sort of keeps everyone in check that way, that you really can't take yourself too seriously.
No, you can't. And that's a good thing. You know, it keeps you grounded. In the real world. But sometimes it's not a good thing because you think, well, hold on, mate. So somebody does anything good, somebody does anything well, people want to pull them down. And that's not such a good thing. But it certainly keeps you, you know, kind of realistic about things. When you're portraying characters, for instance, you know, you try and they're going to see right through you if you're not putting in a good, convincing performance. If it's not a real portrayal.
And
you think, well, you know, that's the kind of audience, you know, you kind of judge by, which is good.
So you grew up in Sheffield, and then at what point did you what was Sheffield like when you were growing up, and is it still the same, or do you feel like it's changed?
It's different now. You know, it used to be a big working class industrial city, big steelworks. You know, they call it the Steel City, it's like Pittsburgh over here, and I guess it, you know, there's many similarities. You know, there was coal mining, and but you know, that was. That's kind of decreased quite significantly now after the bitch Margaret Thatcher got her fucking teeth into it. So don't get me onto her anyway for a start. But I mean, she systematically went through the whole shipbuilding, steelworks, industrial cities, and pulled them apart, you know, as a personal vendetta. But that's another story. But I mean, Sheffield is a good working class town, good people in it, and I got back there quite often. My mother and a lot of my family live up there, and I go up to watch the football and stuff like that. But you know, it has changed. I guess it's lost a lot of its traditions and trades and craftsmanship, but it's still a good place where people are very down to earth, very friendly, and you know, and they kind of know me up there, but they're not overly impressed. But I'm very proud to be from there, and they keep my feet on the ground, but they're proud of me. So
that's nice, though. I mean, it's nice. It's sort of like family. Because it's so easy. Well, especially coming off of like Comic-Con, where it's easy to get super inflated because your face was on the side of a hotel. Imploring people. Yeah. You know, it's like, it's funny, this show Legends, where they're basically, I think it's a brilliant tactic where it's almost like an appliance salesman. Where they're like, we guarantee you we are not going to kill Sean Bean on the show. He's not going to fucking die. You give us your attention. Sean Bean lives.
Should have t-shirts with that, shouldn't
you? I think there is one. I think they did make one. Lives. Yeah, they gave us some when we
it's
came
very
in.
Good quality cotton, isn't it?
Don't kill Sean.
Don't kill Sean Bean.
I mean, the outcry after seeing you die time and time again in things and having people having their heart broken, it's nice to know that we get a living Sean Bean for an entire series.
Yes, I hope so.
They really fucked up the first episode. Like, oh yeah, we fucking killed him. Yeah. You guys totally bought into that.
They're reshooting the end as we speak. Another accent.
Where'd he go? Oh, he died.
You said you were going to kill him.
He was wearing one of them.
You bought into that? That's fucking crazy. Did you just go in and do panels at Comic-Con, or did you spend any time there?
I didn't go to Comic-Con.
Oh, I thought you were there.
No.
Oh.
Just
your face looking over the convention center from the Marriott.
No, I couldn't make it. My daughter was getting married.
Congratulations.
My youngest daughter, thank you. And, you know, so obviously I was over there with her. So,
how many kids do you have?
Three girls.
Are they all married?
No, she was the first one to get married, you know. It's only on Saturday.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, you're already here doing this.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Wonderful day. He's a good man.
Do you play the bad cop father-in-law, or are you like, I'm your buddy until you fuck up? Like, how do you
kind of a bit of both, really? No, he's a lovely guy. They're only young. I mean, she's 22, and you know, he's just a little bit older, but they're very much in love, and it was a gorgeous day, you know. And he's a great guy, great kid. So I'm really happy for them. You know,
that's cool.
That's fantastic.
Totally in love.
Is it strange? It must be. I don't have any kids, but it. You know, I mean, your kids are adults. They're people. They're like they're people that make choices, and they're going to have kids. And is that weird you out at all, or do you think of it as like, oh, this is just a part of the life, and it's a nice part of the process?
Yes, you think like that, but it is. It's like, you know, especially with my middle daughter Molly. She's always seemed like the youngest to me. I mean, she's got very young at heart, and it's quite, you know, it's sometimes, you know, seeing her getting married, it's kind of strange, but it's beautiful, you know. It's a beautiful occasion, and but it's it only seems like, you know, it's a cliche, but only a few years ago she was a toddler, you know, and I was carrying her around and throwing her in my arms and laughing with her. But it was that's it, I guess, you know. And they've got a great future to look forward to. They want kids, and they're happy together, and you think, great, I'm very fortunate, you know, that. You know,
did you do a toast? Did you do a big toast?
Yeah, I did a speech, which was a bit scary.
Yeah.
After, you know, because you kind of want to get a speech over with and have a drink, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And you can't get to have too many drinks before the speech. Exactly. It goes real bad. Yeah. It becomes a personal thing.
But it was good. But that was quite nerve-wracking, you know, doing it.
Well,
doing your daughters, you know, thanking everyone and, you know, expressing it, you know, that to families and friends and people who are very closest to you. And it's quite nerve-wracking, yeah. But, you know, I wrote one out, but I didn't really stick to it. I find it really hard to, you know, that one, and I like to think.
Of course.
And you make jokes and stuff like that. But, you know, I guess I made some jokes, but. They were funny, man.
It's kind of fun because people probably expect, they go, oh, well, you know, he's a theatrical performer and he's done theater and film, and this must be really easy. But I find that, you know, there are some performers that just like being other characters, like don't have to be themselves. But when you get up, even in a small group of people, and you're like, I'm exposing myself to you for who I really am, like that seems, that's scary,
the worst,
right?
Isn't it? Yeah. Because you haven't got a script, you know, and you kind of talk it from your heart.
Yeah.
No. Somewhere. But
I mean, you don't really have to, for any character you're playing, you don't really have to bear any responsibility for that character. Yeah, someone wrote this and I'm doing it.
Exactly, you can do what you want.
Made up. It's not
my
real,
fault.
Not a real guy. Yeah.
I know, people still give Russell Crowe shit for Romper Stomper, so there's a little bit of that. I did play a Nazi.
Well, they said to me when I got my head chopped off in Game of Thrones, and they said, why did you? I said, I don't know. It's not my fault. And I said, well, you should. I said, I'm sorry. What can I do?
I'm a performer. It said sit there and get head chopped off. I had to get my fucking head chopped off.
Why did you do that? I didn't. Chop me one head off.
George, hey, it's Sean Bean. Why'd you cut my fucking head off? These people keep asking me, and I don't know what to tell them anymore.
I give them your number. Reroute them.
But it is, you know, it's very difficult to think of another show where a character's death that early on in the series is still has such an impact, not only on the fan base, but also on, you know, just the chain of events that occurred after it. But people were very attached to Ned.
Yeah, they were. And, I was surprised because I knew what was going to happen. And, you know, I knew I was going to die when I met the producer and the director, you know, and the restaurant saying, you know, you're going to die at the end of the first series, but it's a good part. I said, okay. But what was I saying?
Well, we were talking about how people get super attached.
Oh, yeah. And you know, of course, and so I knew it, but I guess an audience didn't. People read the books, obviously, did. But, I mean, the large majority don't know what's going to happen. And it was such a shock. And it was, and I'm, you know, I'm quite pleased that people are still talking about it. You know?
Yeah.
I'm very flattered by it, because he was, you know, the one good man in the show, and the kind of moral compass. He kind of, there was boundaries, there was a reference point for morals and, you know, and ethics and a moral code, as it were. And he was, once they got rid of him, it was kind of mayhem and chaos.
Yeah.
I'm really kind of proud of it, you know. I think it's a great show, and I'm very pleased to have been one of the people that established, you know, in the first place.
Yeah, I didn't.
And that's why we all talk like this, because of me.
Yeah,
it's true that.
I didn't think that was allowed. I remember watching the show, and then when you died, I was like, is that allowed to just get rid of the main guy?
I didn't think this soon?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, he'll probably some magic will happen, and he'll come back.
Nope.
No.
But they killed that guy, Joffrey. I mean, he was horrible. He was brilliant. I mean,
he was great. Oh, yeah. He was great in that role.
And fantastic, wasn't he?
He was great because every time you see that little fucking scowl, you're like, I fucking hate that character.
Yeah.
Just get pissed.
Yeah.
Because he just looks like Joffrey looks like the kid in your class that you just fucking hate. You're like, I don't know. I just don't fucking like that guy. Yeah. Like, he just seems he just scowls.
Yeah. Yeah.
Something
you
about
can't
him.
Touch him because he's a little snitch or his dad's a cop or something.
Yeah.
Or the headmaster.
And he knows it. He knows you can't fuck with him.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what it is.
You know who my dad is?
Damn it. Fine. But it kind of seems, you know, there's kind of a nice Ned's legacy seems to have trickled down, which is kind of nice too, though. I mean, like that you see traces of him in other characters, and I kind of feel like that's the legacy that people leave behind in life.
Yeah.
Like, you know, did you give your daughter and her husband, did you think of like, I have to give them the perfect piece of advice? Did you figure out what that was?
In Game of Thrones.
No. I'm sorry. I jumped topics.
You went back into real life.
I went back into real life.
Give him a second to acclimate to real life.
Okay. And we're back in real life. Okay. Did you, as a father, think of like the perfect thing to say, like, as you go forward in life, ... Did you give him any?
Not really, no.
Have fun.
Good luck.
Good luck, I guess.
Good luck.
Be nice.
But I guess you do it as you're going along, and they kind of grow, and you grow with them, and they look at you by your actions, I guess, by the mother and father's actions with the parents and stuff and what they do. And what, you know, and if you're a twat, then they're not going to grow up like twats, aren't they? But if you're a decent, you know, I mean, if you, I don't know, I'm not kind of expert on not to bring up children, but I think like if you do, you know, you're generally good, decent person, you know, think about others and, you know, see how you don't treat them badly, and I think your kids see that, and they grow up respecting that. I don't think you can really tell your kids, don't do this, don't do it. Well, you can, and I have, but you can't. They're not necessarily going to listen to you. If they see it by example, that it sinks in.
Well,
and they respect that, you know.
Because as you know, you're, as a parent, you're a person, and you have your own wants and desires. And so I always wonder, like, you know, when I if and when I have kids someday, how am I going to know if I'm being a twat or not? Like, how am I going to know if I'm not? And what sort of keeps what, you know? Because sometimes you just make selfish choices without realizing you're making selfish choices. Yeah. So how do you balance that? How do you know?
Like me on Saturday, you know, I thought, what am I supposed to do here? You know, well, I knew what I was supposed to do. I'd walk her down the aisle.
But I mean, how do I walk?
It was, it's like kind of the things in between and before for the wedding and after. Because it's never happened before. And I don't think you can never have anybody teach you how to do anything like that.
That's
but it's
point,
a beautiful
yeah.
moment because it's your child and you're giving away to a future husband. And it's a lovely time, but you can't rehearse it or plan it. You don't know how you're going to be feeling.
Yeah.
And it's such an extraordinary feeling. It's a, you know, it's a, and you know, they seem older than you then for some reason. But then again, I've always thought that. I mean, the kids seem to be more grown up than I do sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, you still, you know, it's like the older you get, you still feel this. You still feel like you. You're still
some level. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, yeah. I mean, and I guess we all have that kind of childlike quality about us, you know. And that's a good thing, isn't it?
Because if you lose
that, then you're not curious, you know.
Yeah.
You're not understanding to others, you know.
Yeah, the kind of people that just kind of go, I got a handle on it.
Yeah.
I know all I need to know. And then I think they get older a lot faster than people
me too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just they'll just continue. They'll just, you know, you see those people where you'll see someone the same age, but just some guy that just sits around not wanting to learn anymore just becomes like an old man. And then their body starts falling apart because their mind's not.
Well, it takes energy. It takes energy to be curious. It takes energy to want to investigate things and learn new things.
Yeah.
And especially, I think the older you get, the more your body is like, don't learn anything new because it's risky and it might kill you. You know.
Yeah.
And so you kind of have to fight that urge to go, no, that's how you.
Yeah.
That's how you live.
Well, I know what I know, and that's enough for me.
Yeah. Yeah. But if you were that person, then you wouldn't be. I mean, you wouldn't be out living the life you're leading. You know, you would have stayed in Sheffield and probably started working in a factory.
Absolutely.
Or something.
Yeah, that's what I did. You know, for the first, you know, when I left school and worked with my father for about 3 years in a steelworks. But, you know, and that could have continued, and that's what we did, you know, in them days, you know, went into apprenticeship as a steelworker or something. But, you know, that I knew that wasn't for me, so I became an actor, a Ponzi actor in down London.
I'll go play a steelworker in a movie.
I'm going to... Yeah. I know how to do that. Yeah. The experience. Put that under special skills in your resume. Steelworking. Yeah. Got that down.
It would be funny that if I played a welder. I know how to do that.
What year was that you decided to go to... Did you go to London specifically for acting, or did you just go to London to just experience life?
I got into RADA. In London, Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, and I went down there and I got a place in there, so I was overjoyed and, you know, very excited about that. And I went to London, and I'd never really been down there before except for day trips and stuff like that. So that was a massive cultural shock for me at the time. I just wanted to go back home. But I obviously gradually got used to it and enjoyed it being at drama school, and that was it then. You know, I didn't, once I made my mind up, you know, I didn't do no looking back, and I've never looked back since. You know, I was very convinced about what I wanted to do, and that's it. I can't imagine doing anything else, you know.
Yeah.
Do you think you made that choice, or do you think the choice was sort of made because you were drawn to it? Did you make that decision yourself, or was it like, if I just feel compelled to have to do this?
Yeah, I was kind of drawn to it. I didn't think I was going to be an actor when I was at school, and all. I thought it was a bit sissy-ish, you know, a bit fairy, like, you know, because it was like frowned upon slightly.
Yeah, imagine
like,
that kind of neighborhood. Yeah.
Become an actor.
Yeah. Too good for the steel mill.
Yeah. And, you know, so I didn't really, I would never have dreamed that that would happen, but, you know, I was always, you know, I like to draw and paint and I like music, you know, I like the arts in general, I guess. And I think acting, I wasn't particularly good at drawing, painting or music or anything, but acting I felt very comfortable with, and I felt, you know, that was it. I thought, I found something here, you know, I had no idea where I was going, you know, when I was young at all in my career and anything. And then started acting, I felt so comfortable and so kind of safe inside that was it.
Do you feel like you, through that process, you learned more about yourself, or did you feel pretty comfortable with yourself before that?
Yeah, I think you learn more about yourself, and but I didn't feel that comfortable. No, I was just grasping for I didn't know what I wanted to be, but that wasn't a problem. You know, that was quite interesting.
Yeah.
You know, no, I mean, there's all this thing now, you should, you know, grow up and find what you want to be. But the interesting part is, you know, finding that out, you know, and exploring different avenues and making mistakes or seeing what you're good at, what you're not good at. And,
yeah.
But I don't know about you guys, but, you know, they were fun times exploring, dabbling with music or this and that. And you know, great times. It's about growing up, being a kid, being a teenager. And I certainly didn't miss out on that.
Yeah,
You know, when I found acting about 1920, that was the thing for me. And it's funny, you know, I've never felt like that about anything, and it's the last thing I would think would be an actor. But I am, and I can't imagine doing anything else. As I said,
was your family pretty cool with it, or did they were like, "You're going to do what"?
They were a bit, "You're going to do what?" Yeah. I just went into the living room one day and they sat, you know, and the armchair in one of the city, and I said, "I'm going to be an actor." And I went, "What?" I said, "Reading the newspaper." What are you talking about? You know, and it was, but I made my mind up by that point. But they were kind of, you know, they're a bit doubtful about it at the beginning, and quite rightly so, because it was, you know, it's not something that kind of you. Not that many people did, you know.
Yeah.
And go down to London and be an actor, you know. I think it was a little bit scary for them, maybe. But they were ever so supportive, you know, once they knew I'd made my mind up. And they were, you know, throughout my career, you know, I've got a lot to thank them for in that way.
Well, that's good. Because obviously, they must have instilled you with some kind of values that made you feel like you were free to make that choice.
Yeah.
To begin with.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It wasn't. I was not afraid of going in. You know, there was. You know, obviously, I'm becoming an actor. I had the freedom to do, you know, whatever I wanted to pursue. You know, they never kind of stifled me or told me what I should do and what I should do that. You know, and I'm forever grateful for them to, you know, being kind of free in that way, you know, freeing me up to discover myself, discover what I wanted to do, you know.
Yeah.
Very, yeah.
What was the first thing they ever saw you in? And were you scared?
I did a play at this school. Well, it wasn't. It was a college. Like I was about 18, and it was called "Arsenic and Old Lace." Have you heard of that? I think Boris Karloff did it. It was old black and white film. It was a play originally, and I did that. And I played this big scary guy in it, and they'd never seen me do anything before, and they couldn't believe it was me. They were saying, God, Sean, you look so like you believed what you were doing. That's the idea.
I've never seen you have such confidence in your abilities.
I think they just thought, wow, he's transformed himself a bit. He's not like our Sean. yeah.
When did you start to feel like you were figuring it out? Or when did you start to feel that, I do understand how to control it. I would imagine when you first start acting, you're probably just all over the place. And you're kind of, like you said, grasping.
Yeah.
And then at a certain point, you must feel like, oh, I figured out how to harness this. Like, when did you start to feel that way?
I think when I'd learned my lines. I don't know. It's I guess when I got into drama school, that was a big boost for me, you know. And I guess when people started thinking, well, yeah, you're pretty good at that, you know. And people were supportive, or believed in you, you know. And then, you know, you start believing yourself a bit more. And I always did believe in myself, but I mean, it was good. It was good to have people kind of recognize that I wanted to do something a little bit different.
Yeah.
And they were quite easy about that. They were okay about that. And then, you know, gradually getting into it and getting jobs, getting into RADA. I mean, that was such a big break for me. Probably the biggest break I've ever had in my life, because it changed my life around completely. And I was introduced to that world, which was wonderful. And then that gave me that strength, that confidence, and, you know, that kind of built up. But I mean, you always get knocks, you doubt yourself, you know, over and over again. But you also learn a lot of stuff, and, you know, you learn your craft, and that's a kind of defense mechanism.
But it is a defense mechanism, absolutely.
I suppose learning your craft, and it is a craft, really. You know, there are certain qualities that you learn, like just like any other job. You make big mistakes, but I mean, it is something where, unless you throw yourself out on a limb, you know, and throw caution to the wind, which I think is a good thing, then you don't learn very much and it's not very exciting.
Right.
But you might be wrong sometimes. You might try something in a role. I've done it in Legends, and tried something, it maybe didn't work, but sometimes when it does work, it's really worth it. But it's quite scary at the time, you know, because you think, shit, shall I try this or not? You know, you think, why not? You know, and that's where you start learning. If you're steady and you're safe all the time and you think you know what you're doing, then, you know, you're not that good. I don't know. It's like football, a soccer player. When you see these soccer players who try something different, that flair, and they might do it. They might look stupid and fall flat on their face, but when they pull it off, they think everybody's wow.
Yeah, it's worth it.
It's a kind of yeah.
But you have to. I mean, like you have to. It's sort of like what you were saying earlier, Jonah, about not getting too rigid. I feel like it's a bad long-term plan to not take risks and try, because it's just it's longevity. You know,
yes.
It keeps you. It keeps you relevant, or at least it means that you're still asking questions, you know,
yes.
As opposed to just like the safety guys just shrivel up because they're not experiencing anything new.
And you're asking an audience questions as well. And, you know, I mean, it's embarrassing sometimes. You know, I still get embarrassed and think, you know, like, a bit like, oh, God, here, you know, but I don't get that embarrassed. But I mean, I get it's not kind of a stride to think I know exactly what I'm doing. You know, I don't know if you ask an audience question. I think this is what the Legends does. You know, it's a psychological kind of drama thriller. I believe, and it's something that's, you know, it's about a character that takes risks, and I'd like to think I I've took some risks in the various legends or characters that I play in this, and it's been extraordinary fun. But I think all the
Well, the like being a performer, though.
Stop me if I'm
going. No, please. No, listen. A lot of this podcast, to be quite frank with you, is me just trying to understand. I mean, there's a lot of. I feel like I don't know anything, and so I wouldn't think of this as an interview. As more of a conversation of someone who's like, "What have you figured out?" Because I want to I want to try to figure out.
Yeah,
I just want to try to figure it out.
And he's trying to steal your essence, is what he's saying.
So there's a point lately that I've been kind of stuck on, and if you have something to say about it, that'd be great. And if not, I'll totally fuck off happily. But particularly with performing, you said that other people kind of tell you like, "Oh, that was good." Like, it's strange to me that this is a business where you have to get really inward, but to know whether or not you're doing a quote-unquote good job, the validation comes from other people.
Yes.
So how do you know? You know, there's this idea of, like, where do you place your self-esteem? You know, like, I feel like we as a species spend so much time placing our self-esteem in external things.
Mm-hmm.
Validation from other people, you know, power, money, whatever it is, anything that's not you. So how do you... I feel like the healthiest thing is like, well, I'm just naturally comfortable with myself, and it doesn't fucking matter if anyone thinks that or not.
Yeah.
Do you feel comfortable with yourself? And if so, how did you figure that out? Can you write it down in list form?
I don't know. I feel comfortable with myself when I'm playing a role or I'm playing a part. I feel completely comfortable, and I forget absolutely everything, you know, around me. I'm kind of totally focused on that, and you even forget pain, you know, if you've got a headache, if you've got, you know, pain. It's amazing. It's like a kind of elixir. It's like some kind of anesthetic sometimes when you act. I find, and as soon as you say cut, your headache comes back, your hangover comes back. There is a kind of magical spiritual thing to acting that everything kind of goes completely out of your head, and you just become totally engrossed in what you're doing. It is quite I don't know how you would explain that. It's like in a kind of trance, you know, trance-like state.
Which is interesting because acting is a profession where you spend the least amount of time doing the thing you're actually trained to do. Because you're probably just in the most of the time, you're just like, okay, we got it. I'll go sit in the trailer for 7 hours.
Yeah. You're doing a lot of that, a lot of hanging around, and it's just keeping focused on that. But I'm saying that, you know, you're kind of very intense and immersed in what you're doing. But as soon as you stop, you become very self-conscious again. You know, it's about the only time that you feel kind of free and, you know, not conscious of, not inhibited by things around you and people's beliefs or people think of you. But as soon as you stop acting and they say cut, then, you know, all those little niggles and worries and things come back. And as actors, we're not, certainly not the most kind of confident and secure and, you know, stable of people. Paranoid. But we are when we're in the moment.
I wonder why we're so fragile. I don't know. It's such an interesting... I sometimes think it's the same things that make you good at this type of a job are also the things that make life difficult sometimes because you're so hypersensitive to things around you.
People watching you all the time, I guess.
Sure.
I mean, you're putting yourself up there and people to be observed. And so you can become like hypersensitive, you know, about that. But that's it, isn't it? If you put yourself in that position and you get that, but you also get great positive kind of things from that, you know. People like your work and respect and admire, and you bring something to someone's life and they tell you that, and that's a great thing, you know. It's an accomplishment, and you know, I'm not being arrogant, but I think it is. It's something that you bring, and I'd like to think that I do. And so, you know, you get your pros and your cons with it.
What do you think you know now that you didn't know when you... Like, what if you could tell young Sean, like, who's just entering RADA, like, hey, and you'll be fine in a couple of, you know, like what advice would you give your young self now? What have you learned?
I guess not to get too uptight about things. Nothing's kind of that important. Mm-hmm. There's always something, everything's got, you know, there's always a silver lining to a situation. So long as you've got kind of the conviction and confidence in what you do, you know, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
You know, nobody, you're not being arrogant, you're not being a, you know, you believe in yourself, you'll go a long way. You know, if you believe in what you're doing and you try and portray the truth, whether that's in your performances or anything really, but certainly in your portrayals, then you can't go wrong. You really can't.
Do you think arrogance is a way that we deal with overcoming, like trying to forcibly overcome discomfort? You know, like if we're scared or if we feel weird about something or uncomfortable, then we just get super arrogant because we're trying to convince ourselves, like, no, I know this thing. Fuck you. I know this thing.
Yeah.
We really don't.
Yeah. I do that sometimes. Yeah. And, but at the same time, I'm thinking that shit.
Yeah.
They're right.
I think it's nice to know that everyone kind of has that feeling of like, oh yeah, they're gonna figure it out sooner or later. They're gonna know.
Yeah, snuck into the party. They'll see.
They'll see. Yeah. Sir, do you have a pass? Yeah. No, I have.
What's that?
What I do.
But then there's arrogance in there. I mean, sometimes that's a good quality. You know, you see some great soccer players, some great actors, some great politicians who are arrogant, and you think, thank God they're being truthful, and think, oh God, they're telling the truth.
Yeah,
you know, and I think it's not a negative quality.
Yeah.
Did you run the Sheffield team for a while, or were you on the board of?
I was on the board of directors for a little while, yeah, and that was good. You know, it was about 10, 12 years ago now, and I kind of stepped down because I couldn't get up there that much, and I was working, and but it was an interesting time. You know, I've always been a fan. I've always kind of tried to get to the games. I've got a lot of friends who, you know, I meet up with still, and a lot of the Sheffield United fans, but it kind of wasn't for me. You know, I kind of saw the club in a bit more detail, and it kind of took the glamour away. But,
it turned your passion into a chore.
Yeah, I don't want to say this. I'd rather be sat on the terraces imagining how great we are. And but it was a valuable insight for me, and I've still got friends that are on the board, and the chairman, Mr. McCabe, he's a friend of mine, and his sons, and so it's a good, you know, we all know each other. But I mean, I prefer, I don't know, it's like seeing behind a film set or a stage, you know, a theatre production. You see behind the scenes, you think, oh shit, is that what they do? And I always believed it in it all. I believed it all.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, I know. I do voiceovers for cartoons, and occasionally they'll bring like tour groups of kids to watch them record, to watch us record. And I think to the kids, it's going to be like, oh my God, this is going to be amazing. And they go, and they're just like watching grown-ups stand around talking into a microphone.
Yeah.
And it's, the cartoon's gone.
Yeah. Shatters and it's just, your illusions.
It's just totally shattered, and the kids tune out instantly.
Yeah, yeah. I know. It is. Sometimes you don't want to know how things work, do you? You don't want to see the inside workings of something. You just want to see them.
Most of the restaurants tell you that. I don't want to know.
Well, it's not. I think we need.
You want to see the kitchen.
Yeah. Yeah, the sign said it was a B. I'm sure it's fine.
Yeah. That guy?
We need to kind of have those little bits of magic where we don't know exactly what's going
on. Mystery.
Yeah.
Mystery. Imagination.
What was. How long did you live in New Zealand for Lord of the Rings?
It was nearly a year, yeah, I think. Because we were all together for, well, I think some of them were there for a little longer. Because we did all three at once, you know, it wasn't like one after the other.
Right.
There's some days, I mean, we'd be doing like, well, I wasn't because I got killed after the first one.
No!
I can tell you that now.
No.
But it was brilliant, you know. It was a brilliant time, and we spent about they're yours, aren't they?
No, you can play with my sunglasses, with please. Sorry about that. I'm honored.
That's a
funny habit I've got. But it was a wonderful time to be there, and you know, Lord of the Rings, and we didn't know it was going to turn into what it was and how big it was, and you know, and he had all these actors all thrown together, and it was just, it really was a magical time, that, you know, and it was just in the middle of nowhere, you know, away from everyone, away from the studios, producers and stuff. They couldn't really kind of, they couldn't make it with something that it wasn't. I'm not saying that they did want to do that, but I think Peter Jackson was quite pleased that he was on an island, and by the time he got news from America, he'd already shot the scene. Did exactly what I wanted to do, but it was a great time. Yeah, and so kind of lived there. And
it must be nice to shoot that, and then you see it on screen. You're like, we made that.
Holy, I know. Shit. Yeah, and it's something that you kind of set in store, and we set all those characters. We breathe life into them and give them that kind of stamp of a. You know, you think of like Viggo Mortensen as Aragorn now, and you know, and the Hobbit is Dominic, because he's, you know, and Dominic Monaghan, yeah. You know, was all these people, and that's all you see is their face, and that's a great thing, because it was, I mean, obviously such a historic book, such a great, you know, a classic, that you think, wow, we're them now. We put our face to all these fans' minds, all these readers, all this audience. You know, it's something I think we're all very proud of. You know.
So before we let you go, because I know you have a full press day, we talked a little bit about Legends. Do you know when is it? When is Legends premiering?
August 13th.
Oh yeah, just a couple of weeks.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
Is this because your character essentially, you character hop every episode, basically?
Well, it was like that originally, but I think they kind of. I'd think about that, because it almost seemed a bit silly, you know, to be in this week I am playing Texan Renek. It becomes like, now it's a kind of story where, like, Martin Odom is the kind of anchor, you know, and the central kind of man, and he is he changes his character in order to go undercover, but he actually enjoys it a lot, you know, because he's not a very kind of, he's a man who's not quite sure of his whereabouts, his history, who he is. His wife is estranged. He's desperately trying to get back with her and his son, and he's working undercover for the FBI, and he leads a very lonely life, and he's very isolated, and you know, I think his kind of addiction is to go into different characters, different legends. Yeah,
interesting.
Because he's happier and he's more alive.
Do you feel parallels? Do you feel parallels?
There is, yeah. There is. You know, exactly. It's like we were talking about. You know, that's when you kind of forget everything, and and all pain goes away.
Yeah.
But I mean, he is someone. I'm playing someone who's playing someone who's playing many other people. So that's where that kind of, it's like Russian dolls.
The nesting dolls.
Yeah. And that's what I found so interesting, fascinating about this, is that, you know, to see why people really like to play other people or be other people sometimes, you know. Is it because we're not happy with ourselves and we want to get into a fantasy world? You know, because this guy really is happier being someone else, and... Plus, he doesn't know who he is either.
Right.
So that's a few issues.
Yeah. He's got some shit to sort out. Yeah. But the important thing is that you don't die. So
no.
I'm, at least as far as we know at this point, the promise has been made.
Is that right? I'm looking around. I'm not sure.
Yeah. But it's been really lovely chatting with you.
Oh,
and thank you so much for
likewise.
Having us come to the hotel. And and good luck with Legends.
It's a pleasure.
Hopefully
thank
we'll
you.
We'll see you again
much.
Soon sometime.
Yeah. Thank you.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks. That was great.
Cheers.
Hope you had a good time.
Oh, would you mind signing off the podcast by telling everyone? We say enjoy your burrito at the end of the podcast. It's basically
enjoy
just...
Enjoy your burrito.
Yes, yes,
so
yes.
Did you say that?
Yeah, yeah.
Enjoy your burrito.
It's way better.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.